Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3092, United States of America versus Charles E. Moore, appellant. Mr. Taylor for the appellant, Mr. Ambrosino for the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. We raised several issues in our brief, but I'd like to focus at least initially on the Brady issue. When the government was midway through its final witness in the trial of this case, the prosecutor candidly admitted when he was trying to get some documents into evidence that without those documents, the government would have no evidence that Mr. E. Moore had received any of these computers that were at issue. And the court responded by saying, you're virtually conceding, I think, Mr. Prosecutor, that without those documents, you don't have a case. Maybe this case just ends after the government's case in chief under Rule 29. And while that colloquy was going on, some of the most important evidence in this case, a videotape given by Orlando Marshall more than 4 years earlier, given to the police and videotaped, that videotape was sitting on the prosecutor's desk back at his office. That tape contained critical evidence, and it was critical Brady evidence. And we submit that it was Brady on at least 3 points. The first is, did Charles E. Moore essentially confess when he spoke with Orlando Marshall hours, if not minutes, before he gave that statement to the police, as Marshall testified to more than 4 years later at trial? Second, did E. Moore know those computers were stolen, or was he instead simply the beneficiary of another employee's employee discount, namely Michael Ralph? And third, was Mr. E. Moore involved in what came to be called phase one of the trial, during which there was testimony about cash payments being made, or was he only involved in what came to be called phase two, in which Mr. E. Moore was writing checks for these computers? We submit that all three of these are critical points. I'd submit that the confession issue is probably the most important. At trial, Orlando Marshall testified that when he talked with Mr. E. Moore after a search warrant had been executed at Marshall's house, that E. Moore told him basically that he was going to lie to the police and say that he had gotten these computers legitimately. As the Supreme Court acknowledged in the Fulminante case, a confession is like no other evidence in terms of its damage to a defendant. It's the most probative and damaging evidence against a defendant. Here, evidence or testimony about that confession came out while the defense counsel was cross-examining Mr. Marshall.
Can I just ask one question about that? I tell you, what he testified to at the trial, Marshall, was that E. Moore said he was going to say that he got the computers legitimately.
That's what he said.
Right.
And when you read the cross-examination, right, you can almost feel the spear going through defense counsel's
I understand that part of it, but there was no the tonality aspect of it. But there's no place where he says that E. Moore confessed to me that he did it.
No, that's my term.
Yeah, and not only is it your term, it's not. And I don't mean to denigrate that, but the way in which it becomes a confession is Marshall saying, oh, yeah, he says that he emphasizes that word. And then there's some question later that he never told you that he knew, and you never told him. And that's a cross-examination. And Marshall says, yeah, that's right, but he knew, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't have to tell him, right?
He did say that.
Right. But so that's not something, though, that came from the video. So what I'm trying to do is separate out. There isn't really a confession in the video. It seems to me the problem, if there is a problem here, is what the district court allowed in with respect to Marshall saying, you know, what he thought E. Moore's thought process was in this.
I agree.
But that's not what you're objecting to here.
That's not what I'm objecting to, in part because I don't think defense counsel objected.
Right.
maybe for strategic reasons.
You are not defense counsel.
I was not trial counsel. And I also forgot to say, Your Honors, that I had asked to reserve 2 minutes for...
Well, we don't pay any attention to that anyway.
All right.
It doesn't matter what you say or not.
But Judge Garland, you're right. I mean, I call it a confession, but what he says is, and Mr. Martin, the defense counsel, is pushing him on this, and he's saying, but he really did legitimately buy these, and then Orlando Marshall says, no, that's what he said he was going to buy.
Yeah, so that part, I think, I have to say, if I were defense counsel, I would have objected. That's just total speculation unless he has some grounds for it. But since we don't have that here, I'm trying to figure out what is the Brady aspect of that. That wasn't in the original statement.
Well, what was in the original statement is the total absence of anything that comes close to confession.
Yes, that's a different matter. So there's the absence of this conversation.
The absence of it.
Yeah.
And that statement was given, as I say in the brief and have said here, you know, hours if not minutes after that conversation took place. The trial's taking place some 4.5 years later. And the problem, as I see it, with the way this came out is that defense counsel, he's the one asking these questions in which Marshall's saying, no, that's just what he said he was going to say, making it clear that Marshall had guilty knowledge about which he was going to lie. And defense counsel stood there with a spear through him and no weapon with which to fight back.
Well, there is a weapon. He could have objected to that testimony coming in. And if he failed, we may have a different kind of problem here, but not the one that we have in front of us.
You're right, but it's tough to object when you're the one standing there asking the questions, which, I mean, this came out during defense counsel's
cross,
and your options are sort of limited at that point when you're getting beat up.
Can I ask you just one other fact question? So he was also questioned. Marshall was questioned by the postal inspectors at the same time, right?
Yes.
And there is a number of places where there is good cross, that is, in the sense of you didn't say this to the postal inspector, you didn't say that to the postal inspector. What about this? When he was questioned by the postal inspector, did Marshall say, Emore said he's going to say he got these legitimately?
I don't think he did.
So then you already have the ability to say, you say today that he said, I'm going to say it was legitimate, but you didn't say that to the investigator at the time. And, you don't have the ability to do that with respect to the cop, Tucci, who was doing the videotape, but you could say exactly the same thing with respect to the postal inspector.
You can ask, but the fact of the matter is, the reason that tape is so powerful is because if the defense counsel had that tape, he would have had a weapon with which to fight back on this.
Right, but wouldn't he have had the interview with the postal inspector? I understand your point that tapes are better than transcripts. Is that really the only point, though?
No.
What's wrong with being able to say, well, you say that now, but you didn't say that to the postal inspector?
I think the difference is that in the tape, he's recounting the conversation with Emore. What he says, essentially, it was very innocuous. He says, Emore said, I don't have any merchandise. If the police want to come and look, let them look. And that statement in itself, I think, is telling because Emore obviously knew he had a school full of computers. And if he thought they were stolen, I don't think he'd be so free in saying, you know, let the police come. And that was in the tape statement. The absence of the so-called confession was there too. And the problem is that this testimony about what I am shorthanding as a confession is that it stood there unchallenged. And under the Smith case, this court said, when we look at the government's suppression of impeaching evidence, we don't look so much to how defense counsel was able to impeach the person, which I think is where the government's brief tends to focus. Smith says we look to the ways in which the witness's testimony was allowed to stand unchallenged, and that's the problem here. We have a case that the government admitted was weak. The judge concurred that this may go off after Rule 29, which obviously it didn't. And without the tape, that confession stood there unchallenged. And I think that in a weak case with evidence that the defendant has confessed, the importance of that confession,
You're elevating it to call it a confession, aren't you?
I say it's my term. I mean, I don't see how you can take it any other way because he's saying that Emore said he was going to lie to the police. And to me, the steps behind where you get there are, look, yeah, I know they're stolen. I knew they were stolen, but I'm going to lie to the police and say I got them legitimately. That's why I shorthanded as a confession. And this is an area that I don't think the government does, nor could it argue that the testimony was cumulative. There's simply nothing else that the defense counsel had to challenge.
He could have said, well, you also didn't tell this story to the postal inspectors.
Right, but here we have affirmative evidence of what he says took place in the call, and there's nothing about the confession. And it's on videotape, and it's Marshall's words who's sitting there on the stand, not a postal inspector. Right. Postal inspector, you know, was challenged on a lot of things and could be seen as not having conducted that thorough an investigation to begin with. Ralph testified that she never even asked whether he had told Emore that the computers were stolen. There's a second issue that I think this tape provided Brady evidence, and that has to do with the buttressing of the defense theory. The defense theory was, look, Mr. Emore knew Mr. Ralph. He thought Ralph worked at Gateway. Ralph told him he got an employee discount and that he was just taking advantage of that. And the way that Marshall's tape statement buttresses that defense is that he says, according to him, he understood that Emore was simply buying these computers at wholesale and selling them retail. We argue in the brief that that's not only impeaching but exculpatory. I guess that's neither here nor there. I still think it's exculpatory, but either way, it constitutes Brady. At a minimum, Marshall could have been impeached on that point had the tape been turned over. So on those points, the tape would have given a lot of impact, I think, to the defense counsel's efforts to impeach Marshall, which under the Cuffey and Smith decisions are the definition of materiality under Brady. And under the Brody decision, once a Brady violation has been shown, a new trial is the prescribed remedy, this court has said. But I think there's even a third way that this constitutes Brady. It could have been used to impeach Marshall on whether there was a phase one. It could have been used to show that his story about what happened was substantially different, and that could have been used to show that these three guys, Marshall, Michael Ralph, and Simmons, all got together and cooked up a story and got their details straight. Now, I have to concede that that would have been somewhat cumulative, but the way I think that
there was cross on
there
that,
was.
In which he conceded that he hadn't said that before.
There was. The way I think it would be non-cumulative is that what you get by seeing the tape or reading the transcript of it is the transposition of Emore and Abdul Jalo. When you read through the statement, it's clear that everything that Marshall, everything may be an overstatement, but most of the things that Marshall attributes to Emore during the trial are things that in that tape statement he said J-Lo did, for instance, coming over to his house, bringing money, opening the box at his house. And the reason I think that's important is because by getting into the phase one and allowing that to not be challenged by what he said on the tape, it brought in the whole issue of cash payments. If you're accused of receiving stolen goods, the evidence that you paid cash versus checks, I think, is critical. As Mr. Martin argued with regard to the checks, you don't use checks to pay for stolen merchandise. And if Marshall's statement had come in, the defense would have been able to show that was J-Lo's doings, not Emore's, and that Emore was only involved at a point where he was paying with checks.
Can I ask you one law question? Have you thought about what the relationship between the Brady standard is and the harmless error standard? That is, which is easier for you to prove? If you lost Brady, could you still prove harmless error, or the other way around, if you lose the harmless error on the Jenks, would you still be able to prove Brady? Which is sort of there's a different burden, but which standard is harder, or are they the same, do you think?
I think that harmless error is probably tougher, a higher standard. I think we meet it here.
Which one is higher? I'm sorry.
I think harmless error is. Mm-hmm. I think we meet the harmless error test here for the reasons I've discussed, that Mr. Martin, the defense counsel, is just left without anything to fight back with on these critical points that Marshall was testifying to.
Is this Jenks?
Yes. The government concedes Jenks. It's Jenks.
Excuse me, go ahead.
The government concedes it's Jenks and should have been turned over as Jenks. They argue...
It's Jenks as to the investigator, but it's...
It would be Jenks as to Marshall, the tape statement.
The tape would, but nothing.
Right. The reports of Carr, we argue, are Jenks with regard to Carr, who testified.
Right, Carr, but not...
Right, and we submit that the emails that Carr talks about having been sent between Tucci and the detectives down where Gateway is... We don't know
the content of that at all.
Did
you ask the district court to order that to be produced?
I don't think we did. In our motion for new trial, we pointed out that it hadn't been provided, and you know, we can't argue that.
You have a harder time making it into Jenks without knowing what it is. It might be Brady.
We do, but yeah, and it seems to me, I mean, I understand the rule is that we have to show it's harm, but you can't have a rule that gives the government incentive not to give you stuff so that you can't show it's harmless or not harmless.
We use your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mike Lambrosino of the United States. I'm turning to the materiality component of the Brady analysis.
Well, that's the only one you've got, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you really can't resist either of the first two prongs.
Correct. The only dispute below was whether or not appellant knew these computers were stolen. And in order to place that in the proper context, I'd like to very briefly review the evidence that he did, in fact, know they were stolen. Primarily, Ralph, one of the other cooperators, testified that he specifically told appellant that the computers were hot. The circumstantial evidence was as follows. He paid in cash for a large part of the first part of the scheme. He got as high as an 80% discount on the computers. He paid to Ralph or Marshall, both of whom were not Gateway employees. He often paid at King's Dominion for these computers. He had them shipped to a number of different locations under the names of various aliases. He did not get receipts for the computers. He did not register them with Gateway. He did not have a Gateway employee fix these computers when they broke down. He hired somebody on the side to service the computers at the school. He did not seek reimbursement. He stocked an entire school with Gateway computers, and he did not seek reimbursement from the board of directors.
What's the point of that? Who paid for those?
He did.
So did he stock the school or did he resell the computers?
Both.
Well, as with respect to the first, where he stocked it without getting reimbursed, was this just a contribution on his part? What's the government's theory about that?
Well, if you looked at it in isolation, Your Honor, one could infer, well, maybe he's just doing it out of goodwill. But when you look at it in the context of the entire case, it becomes obvious that I believe in the context of the case that he wasn't paying for these, that he was getting them at such a discount that he just was able to stock the school with them and not seek reimbursement from the board, which he was entitled
to. Why wouldn't he, if he's a crook, which I take it is your theory, mm-hmm. why didn't he either try to get reimbursement or resell them? Crooks don't usually just, you know, give the proceeds of their thefts to a school, unless he's Robin Hood.
Well,
he's Robin Hood.
Is that your theory, that he was Robin Hood?
To that extent, Your Honor. I mean, not to the extent that he was reselling them for his own profit or the fact that he was taking 80% of these stolen computers in this scheme. But as to that one component, yes.
How much evidence, or what was the evidence about his reselling them for money?
There was evidence from Marshall and Ralph that he was reselling them from their testimony, but also the government, as we outlined in our statement of facts, called three of the folks who actually purchased computers.
Did we know what percentage of the ones he purchased he then resold?
No. We know from Simon's testimony that in terms of all the computers that were stolen throughout the course of the scheme, that somewhere between 70% to 80% of them went to Emar. But that was because none of the exact figures got into evidence because the summaries were excluded. It's hard to know the exact figures.
And the other members of the scheme, how'd they get paid? I'm sure I should recollect this, but I don't. How did the other two members of the scheme get paid?
They were taking the other two members. Well, there were three, Your Honor. There was Simon, who was the person at Gateway, and there was Ralph, and there was Marshall. Yeah. Marshall claimed that he really didn't get much of this, that he was just doing this because Ralph was his cousin, and he was only taking about $1,000 out of the whole scheme. That was his claim. Ralph was taking a percentage of the proceeds, and if you recall, the money at times was being deposited directly into his bank account by appellant. Appellant would actually go to his bank account and deposit the money directly into his account, which is actually a factor that I should have added. I think it's unusual if you're making a legitimate transaction that you go in and deposit the money directly into somebody's private bank account.
Into his own account or somebody else's account?
Into Ralph's account.
What's the evidence that he's the person who deposited the money into Ralph's account?
Ralph testified to that, and so did Marshall.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Appellant focuses in on two aspects of the videotape statement, the reference to wholesale and the reference to the conversation. With respect to the reference in the videotape to the term wholesale, there are two important points to be made. First is, one of the items that had been turned over prior to trial was Detective Tucci's summary. And in Detective Tucci's summary, he gives a on page two of his summary, he summarizes the statement that Marshall had given. So they had a summary of this statement, and in that he talks about that very fact. He talks about that Charles Emore was purchasing these items in bulk and that he was getting them at a reduced price because he was purchasing them in bulk.
Say again, what is that in? What?
That is on page two of Officer Tucci's report, and that's one of the reasons, Your Honors, that I filed the I moved to supplement the record in this case. That is the first document in the supplement, Your Honor. That's attachment A.
Bear with me for one second.
Sure. It's the thin one. It's captioned joint motion for leave to supplement record on appeal. Appellant's counsel graciously agreed to join in that motion. So it's the one thin one. The two thick ones are the are volumes one and two of our record materials.
I have it either. What's the filing date on that?
The filing date is September 23rd, 2008.
If any of the clerks likes to bring one up to the bench, we would
help them.
We would not throw them out of the court for contempt or anything like that at this point. I don't think they have it either.
If Your Honor would like me to show somebody, the clerk, what the document looks like.
You want to hand that to the courtroom deputy clerk, and she can hand it to the court then. Unless you have one. That's lovely, that's you. Garland, first. Thank you, ma'am. We will not promise to hand that back to you at the end of argument. We'll likely take that with us.
I will confess, Your Honor, I do not have it memorized. I do have it tabbed.
You have it tabbed. Which is the tab you want us to look at?
The one, I believe it's the, it's the second tab, Your Honor. It's the one, it's the second tab, and I believe it's under number seven is where.
Defense counsel has this available to, do you have it?
I don't have it here.
Okay. Well, we'll pass this back to you, and then we'll ask
you
to give it to us again.
Your Honor, I know it well enough that I can direct Your Honor to the portion that I'm talking about. On the second page, which is attachment A, Officer Tucci talks about the discusses in some detail the statement by Marshall, and this is important in two respects. One, because it does talk about this idea that he was getting these at a reduced rate. It also makes no mention of the phone conversation, which he later testified to. So defense counsel could use it to impeach on, could address his testimony in both aspects. He could address the discount with respect to the theory that he was buying him at some legitimate rate, and he could impeach the absence of any mention of that phone conversation, which counsel places a great deal of emphasis on. Substantively, in addressing this idea that the tape talks about some legitimate wholesale rate, I submit that that's taken completely out of context. If you read that page in its entirety, what Marshall is saying is that merely that appellant was receiving these items at a reduced rate, which is unremarkable concept considering that he was receiving stolen computers. And in fact, Special Agent Winkley specifically asked him, and this is on page 45 of the appendix, he specifically asked him, okay, he was getting the computers for what amount? And his answer there is, I have no idea. And what he goes on to explain is that what he meant by this idea of wholesale was that he was receiving them.
Say we have several appendixes. That part we do have. You're talking about whose appendix here?
Oh, this is appellant's appendix at page 45.
Okay. And this is the examination of?
This is the statement of Marshall.
This is the
transcription of the videotape.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And on page 45, this is where both events occur on this page. There's the discussion of the phone conversation, and then about halfway down the page, he makes reference to the fact that that Emor was, quote, pretty much buying them at wholesale rate from them and reselling them. But he then goes on to explain what he means by that. And as you move further down the page, Special Agent Winkley asks, he specifically asks Mr. Marshall, he was getting the computers for what amount? He specifically asks how much he's paying for them. And he begins his answer by saying, I have no idea. But what he goes on to explain is that the other participants in the scheme are purchasing them for between $300 and $400 a model, and that Emor was getting them at a better rate. And the reason he was getting them at a better rate was because he was buying them in bulk. And this reaffirms that he was the biggest customer. This is completely consistent with his later trial testimony, or at least it's completely consistent with Mr. Simon's later trial testimony, that Emor was the big customer. I will note for the record.
But it's also consistent with a wholesale, meaning buy in bulk, not by theft. Right?
Taken out of context, I would agree, Your Honor.
Which part of the context would you point to?
I would point to the context where he specifically explains what he means by it, because he was asked specifically, how much was he paying? And he begins his answer with, I have no idea. Now, if he was buying them at a legitimate wholesale rate, I would assume that his answer would be one of two things. He was buying them at the wholesale rate, which was as follows. I mean, if you recall, there was testimony at trial from one of the investigators that the official discount rate was up to 18%. That was the employee discount rate. There was a specific rate. Now, he says he does not give a specific rate. He doesn't say...
No way that Marshall would know what the official employee's discount rate. How would Marshall know what the official employee's
discount rate? He wouldn't necessarily, Your Honor, but I think he would say one of two things. He would say he was purchasing them at the official wholesale rate, or he would know exactly what rate he was purchasing them at.
I don't understand that argument. I don't see why the answer... I have no idea was not a possible natural argument without regard to whether it's a legitimate wholesale rate or an illegitimate wholesale rate. He just didn't know. And given the configuration of the conspiracy, he's not the one who would have known, was he? Was he? I mean...
Well, Marshall acknowledged that he knew that these items were stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's acknowledging...
He was not playing such a role that he wouldn't... necessarily know what rate they were being sold at, whether they're legitimate or illegitimate. I don't understand the significance of that testimony to your case.
I'm not arguing that it was significant to our case. To our case here, very well.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear on my statement.
My point is that when you put this in the context of the evidence at trial, paying for these things at such a huge discount between 50 and 80% in cash at King's Dominion with no receipts and so on under various aliases at various addresses. The fact that he was getting them, that he was getting the 80% of all the stolen computers at some kind of reduced rate is somewhat unremarkable. I agree with Your Honor. I don't think it says one way or the other what Mr. Emor's knowledge was. And I'm not sure that Mr. Marshall was in a position at that time or later to testify as to what Mr. Emor's knowledge was, because he candidly acknowledged during trial that he never specifically told him that the computers were stolen. It was Mr. Ralph who did specifically tell him that the computers were hot.
Let me just ask, this document that you gave us also had, this is the postal inspector's statement that you're referring to as well, is that right? There's Postal Inspector Meredith J. Newman. Is that the interview?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's an interview with Marshall?
That's correct. Right. The first report?
Yeah. It's dated December 1st, 2005.
The first report, which would be A, I believe was authored a WASIS report, which would have been authored by the MPD officer on the report, which would have been Vincent Tucci.
That's Tucci. No, the next one. You have it.
Oh, a memorandum of understanding. Yes, that would be document B, Your Honor.
Right. And that's the interview of Marshall. How close in time is that to the Tucci interview?
3 years later. Tucci's summarizing the videotape 3 days after it's taken. Tucci's Exhibit A is Tucci's summary in what's called the WASIS report, basically where they go back to their office and write it up. And that's 3 days or 4 days after. That's, I believe, July the 16th back in 2002. The Exhibit B, which is the memorandum of interview, does not take place until 2005. And as Your Honors can tell, that this investigation moved rather slowly because essentially Mr. Marshall was left alone for a few years, and then he was eventually arrested, entered into a plea agreement.
Okay, one more, just a quick law question. The same law question I asked counsel on the other side. The defendant has the burden in... with respect to Brady, the government has the burden with respect to proving that Jenks' violation was harmless error. You're nodding as to both of those. The defendant's burden with respect to Brady is to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome. The government's burden on harmless error is a little more vague under Kodiakos and Olano. It's affect the outcome somehow. Do you have any? Do you have a view as to whether reasonable probability of changing the outcome, whether that's higher or lower than the affecting the outcome standard?
Under the Lamb case, Your Honor, which does in fact apply the Kodiakos standard, I would argue that the substantial probability of the harmlessness standard would be tougher. I think that's a harder standard.
Tougher for
the harmless error
for the defendant? Or for you?
I think it's tougher for the defense because they have to show there's a substantial probability rather than a reasonable one.
So that's under the
Kodiakos standard, Your Honor.
Jenks.
Right, and this court, as this court so held in the Lamb case, which we do cite at page, 924 F second at page 310.
Of course, then it's hard to balance the difference of the burdens, right?
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Now, is it the case that everyone agrees that we do this de novo?
Yes.
Without deference to the district judge?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because the existence of the violation and the content of it is agreed upon, and so I would submit that just leaves a de novo review by this court.
Counsel, I think unless my colleagues have further questions, we've talked to you past your allotted time, so... we'll hear from the defense. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you. I think there's another disconnect on the law here between the defense and the government. Mr. Ambrosino started out the argument talking about the evidence that shows that Emore was guilty, but under Cuffey, at the end of that decision, I guess page 518, this court says the remaining evidence standing alone, although the remaining evidence standing alone would have been sufficient to convict, the Brady material inquiry is not an assessment of the sufficiency of the evidence.
But we still have to look at the other evidence to see what the reasonable probability of affecting the outcome would be, right?
I agree with that, and that's
sufficiency
why...
Sufficiency would be like on a motion for judgment of acquittal. That's a different standard altogether than what we have here.
Right, and, you know, here I think what the court's talking about, although I'm not positive, is that just because the government can show a strong case doesn't mean that Brady's not material. I would submit that here the government admitted they had a weak case, and that the fact of
this... That's sort of taken out of context, too, isn't it, that admission of weakness?
It was what the prosecutor said in his last witness when he was trying to get in a document he did not get in. Judge Robertson agreed. Judge Robertson denied our motion for judgment of acquittal, obviously. With regard to Detective Tucci's report, I don't have it with me either, but I believe I heard Mr. Ambrosino say that it doesn't make any mention of the phone conversation. So again, it's hidden from us. Mm-hmm. Whether it's mentioned there or not, the government had an obligation, at least under Jenks, to turn that tape over. We submitted had that obligation under Brady, too. There was no reason that tape should have been sitting over on the trial prosecutor's desk.
I don't think the government's really contesting that they had an obligation under Brady. Their whole argument's been about the third point.
Yeah, the materiality.
Yeah.
And
it's not hidden that there was a phone conversation, right? That is, Tucci's statement says, and I think you acknowledge, you knew that there was a telephone conversation between Marshall and Emore. It's the content that wasn't
the content, and we didn't know there was a tape,
right,
or
right.
Any other kind of recordation of Marshall's statement. I think the legal point was the main one I wanted to make, and the fact that there was an obligation to turn this over, whether it was mentioned in Tucci's
report. You're actually over the 2 minutes, but we talked a lot of it, too. So
all right.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. The case is submitted. Call the next case.